Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you to the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in our program, Past Impressions. I'm Brent Topp, the chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, and I'm your host for this program that examines the history of the Church. I'm honored today to once again have with us as our guest, Professor Richard Bennett of Brigham Young University, Professor of Church History and Doctrine and Associate Dean of Religious Education. Dick, we're just really, really tickled to have you with us again on Past Impressions.
It's an honor to be here, Brent.
We've talked about the getting to Council Bluffs and crossing the Missouri and having to establish that winter quarters, as it would be known for the Saints. Why don't we talk about the actual establishment of winter quarters and some of those events that went into the establishment, and then we'll talk later about how that becomes such a significant, sacred place for the Saints.
One can't speak about winter quarters without first talking about the call of the Mormon Battalion. Last time we established the fact that they set up a way station at Mount Pisgah and back in Garden Grove. It's going to be at Mount Pisgah where Captain James Allen of the United States Army of the West will come, not interfering with the Latter-day Saints, but inviting the Latter-day Saints. On behalf of President James K. Polk, the United States President, to fight in the pending war with Mexico. The Latter-day Saints were well positioned to do this. The story of the Mormon Battalion is well known. They're going to ask, the United States government is going to ask for and will receive a pledge of support from 500 of our most able-bodied men to leave the companies that are going west at the most crucial, difficult time and to go on their great march in behalf of the United States government. That request of the United States Army will sit well with Brigham Young. Frankly, he had been negotiating for this very same thing, unbeknownst to most Latter-day Saints, because it will mean financial remuneration, which they desperately needed in light of the fact they hadn't made any money out of Nauvoo. It was a blessing in disguise, but great disguise. When the request for the battalion is made, Brigham Young will shrewdly, carefully negotiate. Yes, of course. In return for how much money? And you know, I have 12,000 people coming. We're moving west. We need to be able to settle on Indian lands on the west side of the Missouri River. Understand that important point. Because on the east side would mean that they would just delay crossing that river in the following spring and be postponed again. Captain James Allen, without permission of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, well, yes, we need those men, whatever it takes. Yes, you can settle on Indian territory. And of course, he had no authority to do that, but who cares at this point? He is the government. So we receive the right and permission of the United States government to settle on Indian territory, which causes an absolute reaction in Indian Bureau of Indian Affairs later on. But Brigham Young knew that we had to do that.
So two great blessings that came from that would be the actual income that's coming to the soldiers and the families and the companies indirectly.
$22,000 will come when you add it all up, although that money's not coming to the church. That's going to come to those men who will then turn and give it to their wives and family, who will then be asked to consecrate it. Not all do, but most will, and it's a marvelous expression of consecration in the wilderness.
Wow. And then the second portion, the winter quarters, came
That's
as a direct result.
It's of land
Mormon
that we can settle in. Now, there's a risk. There is a risk settling on the west side. You're with the Ponca Indians. You're with the Omaha Indians. And for goodness sakes, don't cause trouble with the Sioux, which are about 130 miles north, the most warsome of all the tribes, and by far the most feared. But these other remnant groups—oh, and by the way, watch out for the Pawnee. They're just 100 miles west, and they're going to attack the other Indian tribes. The Indians were most savage with other Indian tribes. But we'll take that calculated risk. And so winter quarters, as it begins to settle in October, they first started, tried Cutler's Park, which was further south, but later on winter quarters, which is now in northern Omaha, will be the place where we're going to begin to settle. And they begin actually to settle not until October of 46, by the time they get everything, their acts together. And some 3,600 Latter-day Saints will cross the Missouri River in the summer and early fall of 46, and they will be the genesis or the corpus for winter quarters. The other 9,000 there will cross the river in what is Council Bluffs or what becomes Canesville, approximately 4,400 there, scattered in about 60 different settlements, and then back in Mount Pisgah, and then back in Garden Grove, and then some down in St. Louis, wherever they can find a place. There are 12,000 Latter-day Saints accounted for in December of 1846 in their own census, by the way.
Dick, we've talked about the establishment of winter quarters, and you say in October of 1846, we're now getting 3,600 or thereabouts, plus you have all these others on the other side of the river and then spread out all across to Iowa, even clear back to Nauvoo, which we'll talk more about in another episode. That must pose some enormous challenges of organization, of meeting the needs of the people. What are some of those developments that take place in winter quarters to help meet those needs?
The miracle of Mormon organization begins to be shown on those plains and hilltops around winter quarters when to make sure that they're going to provide for that Mormon battalion contingent. Brigham Young made the certain promise, if you go out on our request to serve the United States Army, we will take care of your wives and children. And this is the genesis of Mormon bishops being called, not for large groups that we had back in Nauvoo. I'm not even sure we had bishops in the same sense that we had them at all later on. But in winter quarters, pastoral bishops to take care of maybe 200 or 300 in small little wards of this makeshift community. By the way, there were roads or pathways in winter quarters. And Bishop, you'll take care of this. And Bishop Scoville, you're going to take care of this. And Bishop Walker, you got 200 over here. We never had a stake in winter quarters, but we had some 22 wards just on winter quarters, not on the other side of the river, each one with a bishop. And what was the bishop supposed to do? Make sure that those families get what they need, that we will honor our covenant and promise to take care of you. So coming out of this windswept nowhere is going to be part of the great organization of the church that we begin to recognize later on, of having bishops taking care of smaller groups of people. We have that on both sides of the river. We also have two high councils. As I said, no stake, but we had a high council on the winter quarter side, and we had the Pottawatomie High Council over on the other side. We had high councils back in Garden Grove and in Mount Pisgah. The organization of the church, remarkable, how it's organized to meet the needs.
Driven primarily because of the temporal needs, but certainly spiritual and following the revelations as had been given in the Doctrine and Covenants earlier.
Absolutely. They're going to build a store in winter quarters. It's going to be not unlike the Newell K. Whitney store. And Newell K. Whitney will be in charge of that store.
Interesting.
And he knows how to run a store. We're going to have a council house, the closest thing to a chapel. And that council house will be the center of activity in winter quarters. We're going to have dances. We're going to have choirs. We're going to have great times together. We're going to have balls. And the council house at winter quarters is premonition, if you will, or a foreshadowing of the council house that's going to be built in Salt Lake City and of the tabernacle that's going to be built in Salt Lake City later on. And then you have, of all things, Willard Richards' octagon, potato heap, they called it, because it was just piled with mud all the way through. It didn't look like very much, a true octagon, and it was used for three purposes, Brent. One was to be the post office not a federal post office, but a post office nonetheless.
To get messages back and forth
exactly.
along the plains.
Number two, to be a hospital. And number three, a sacred place for sealings.
Interesting.
Of marriages that were performed. They were sealings. They were call sealings, and they were performed by President Brigham Young. President Brigham Young would listen to his people. He says, they're out in the wilderness. Many of them are on the Mormon Battalion, and here comes young couples who want to be married. Are we going to go back to Nauvoo to be sealed? What are we going to do? And he knew that he held those keys. And so there were several sealings going on in winter quarters. There were baptisms for the dead that were being done in the Missouri River, not just the Mississippi River.
And that's really fascinating to me because, as we talked in an earlier episode of the being driven to complete the Nauvoo Temple and all the work that's being done to do the Nauvoo Temple, and then they abandon it and take off and cross the plains. And so you're saying that temple work doesn't cease just because the temple is left behind.
They are a covenant people. Mm-hmm. And they are not leaving the covenants behind. And they have the keys of the priesthood with them. And yes, of course, many things will be reserved for the building of the temples in the far west later on. Mm-hmm. But there will be some wonderful temple blessings performed for the faithfulness of those saints. There in the middle of nowhere in that dark winter of 46 and 47, the Lord's not going to leave his people alone.
That's so interesting. A different image of winter quarters than we sometimes think, and yet now we have a temple on those sacred lands.
President
there.
Gordon so, B. Hinckley, I believe, fully understood the temple significance of winter quarters.
Wow, that's very, very fascinating. So the octagon was the post office.
So you had the octagon, you had the council house, you had the store, and people are building homes, but most people can't afford to build brick homes, although there were a few brick homes yeah. built using the bricks from some of the forts up the river. Meanwhile, Brent, you've got the 10,000 or 20,000 cattle about 150 miles north, and they're leaving them on what they call the rush bottoms for the winter times. You can't put all that cattle in that mm-hmm. town. Then you've got some of the others that are way up in the Vermilion. You've got the Knights, Newell Knight up there, George Miller, James Emmett. Unfortunately, there's going to be a prairie fire that's going to destroy that group, and Newell Knight himself will die, and they'll have to close that one down. And that they'll come down in January to join the main group at Winter Quarters.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the accommodations, as you talk about that you had very few actual brick homes or homes that we would even think resemble homes today. So from October 1846, as now we have these thousands of saints coming in, what kinds of accommodations do they have to live in?
The accommodations in winter quarters, as well as those across the river in at Pigeon Creek, or later called Canesville, are going to be so rudimentary. To live in your own wagon in the wintertime with that canvas will be a blessing.
Hmm.
Many are digging caves inside the banks of the river, along with the snakes and everything else. They're going to pass the winter and on caves, hovels.
Anything to have
anything
getting
to get
out of
some
the,
sort of protection.
The, yeah.
Now, it doesn't take a whole lot to see that that's not the healthiest, most sanitary place to live. And they've just come through that spring of 46.
Mm-hmm.
And their situation is a dire one, to say the very least. It's one of the most soul-wrenching experiences in my historical research is to see what those people were living through in the fall and winter of 46 and 47 at winter quarters. I mean, they gave everything just to find some sort of shelter. You know, there are not many trees in that area, mm-hmm. and that's a cold winter.
And the wind just howls on the plains there. So.
And it's damp, and well, they begin to die. They begin to die in numbers that are staggering.
Today on Past Impressions, Professor Richard Bent joins me in talking about the establishment of winter quarters. And Dick, you were just mentioning of the difficulty of the accommodations and the circumstances that they found themselves in dugouts and anything that could provide any shelter. And after the terrible fatigue and the toil of crossing Iowa, you mentioned that then we begin a period of enormous suffering during that winter. Why don't you talk more about the sacrifices of the saints there in winter quarters.
I suppose it's one of the darkest chapters in the history of the church, our Valley Forge, if you will, where so many begin to die. One pioneer family, the Pond family,
Stillman Pond,
who's settling there at winter quarters, will lose not just his wife, not just one, two, or three children, but all five. This is not abnormal. I mean, this is many were losing loved ones left and right. I've counted carefully the records. Between October of 46 and April of 47, over 1,000 will die. Out of a total of 12,000, what percentage is that?
One in 12.
That's more than an epidemic. They're dying to scurvy. They're dying to something like malaria, mosquito-infested country. They're dying from malnutrition.
In fact, remember when we were there this last summer, looking for Mosquito Creek, and I wasn't sure I wanted to know where Mosquito Creek was, but I think that gives you a good picture of what the place was like.
Some are dying almost of starvation. And yet you don't have any sense of mutiny. You will have a few that will turn back. You always will. But no sense of mutiny. That consecration, that sense of sacrifice, that commitment to the cause, even if you don't know exactly where you're going, we're with you. And it still brings tears to my eyes to consider, in that difficult situation, one of the greatest expressions of faith that I have ever read about anywhere.
In fact, I find it so inspiring when you stand up on the burial ground there by the temple and you see that monument there of the mom and the dad burying the child, and then the names of so many that had suffered and died there. And I've always been so fond of the Stillman Pond story. And then you see the names of all of those children, and you look in family after family. But you know, something that you mentioned in an earlier segment that just touched me on this is that despite the hardship and the mental and physical fatigue that they must have been experiencing, that you mentioned that they had dances. I mean, that, how do you reconcile this, what you say is the darkest period in that many of them had known to that time, with also this sense of joy and how do you deal with that?
Well, it had just been a few months before that time that William Clayton had penned his great prairie anthem, the Anthems of the Exodus. Come, come, ye saints. And should we die before our journey through, happy day. All is well. Happy day. We're going to make the best of this no matter what. We'll sing and we'll shout and we'll dance and we'll do whatever we can to make this a happy place. We'll do it the way the Lord wants us to do it. And it's just amazing how they will bring such expressions of positive living in such a negative environment. And they will wrestle that environment to the ground. But there will be some objections. Along comes George Miller and a few others saying, Brigham, you're going the wrong way. Our people are dying every which way. Do you know what you're doing?
Want to get them up into the Indian land.
Do you know what you're doing here? And there's going to be defection. And on the 25th of December 1846, George Miller is trying to rally those around him to have a mutiny against the 12. Brigham Young is quite sick that day, on Christmas Day. He's out for a walk. They don't expect him to come around their tent. And he listens into this talk, this mutiny talk, and he walks right in, opens the flap, and he says, Brother George, do you have something against me? You have something against the plan of the 12? And they have quite a set to. And that's the last you'll see of George Miller and James Emmett in this church. They'll go down to Lyman White and other places, up to see Strang, what have you. It's a sad story. But not long after that, within a month, Brigham Young will reveal his only canonized revelation, which is now section 136, the word and will of the Lord. And most of us look at that and we say, well, this is about the captains of 50s and the captains of 10s and all of that. It's a wonderful blueprint for the future Exodus. And there's no question that in the winter of 46 and 47, they're planning for the spring Exodus. But number one, I believe, in that section is we'll go under the direction of the 12. We're not going under anyone else's direction. It's a prairie affidavit of apostolic leadership. And Joseph Smith's life was given for a purpose. and don't try to second guess why. It was validated by the Lord, but now the 12's in charge, and they have the keys. It's a wonderful expression of who's leading this church. And are you with me or are you against us? That's what we're really talking about in section 136. And the winter quarters is a great expression of who's on the Lord's side, who.
You know, we've talked about the time of preparation. We've talked about the time of suffering and sacrifice, Dick. But I think one of the things that would be fascinating to our listeners as well would be, how was the experience in winter quarters different for the women? Or what do we learn from the accounts and the experiences of the great pioneer women? We hear the names of Brigham and Heber and Willard and others of the great leaders. What about some of those inspiring women of winter quarters?
One doesn't understand winter quarters without understanding the sacrifice and the faith of those sisters, the great women of the church. Remember, many of them, their husbands, their fathers, whatever it may be, are in the Mormon Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
Others in church leadership are down in St. Louis. Many of them are down in Missouri working in Missouri farms to provide for their families. The great faith and devotion of the women in winter quarters. They would get together often for mutual support. They would get together to pray, to fast, to teach the scriptures one to another, to express faith in many, many different ways, especially enveloped as they were with the darkness of a Missouri night under the stars, the darkness of that winter, the cold, bleak winter. Their expressions of faith written in their diaries, they should be read by every Latter-day Saint. I'm not saying that women were any greater than the men or men or the women, but the women bonded together in a wonderful sisterhood. We don't have records of Relief Society meetings per se being held in winter quarters. Relief Society would kind of go
in advance for a period of time until
1867, the coming of the railroad. But you certainly have the great devotion of the sisterhood of the saints, many of them exercising faith unto miraculous healings of many around them, especially in that sickness and death period of 46 and 47. So the devotion of the Latter-day Saint women is the backbone of the faith of winter quarters.
You know, there's a famous painting of winter quarters that I think most of us have seen, and it's there in the visitor center. But as you just talked about that, and as we've talked about the suffering and also the joy and trusting in the Lord, you remember in that painting of the dugouts and the little, and yet there is light in all of those little cabins or little dugouts. And I find that very interesting and very symbolic, that even in those dugouts, that the conditions must have just been horrible.
Pathetic.
But out of it comes light. And I think it's more than just candlelight. There is a spiritual light that comes from the great men and women of faith in winter quarters.
Well, there's the light of the covenant.
Yeah.
There's the light of the temple. Many of those women had received their blessings in the temple before they left and were true to those covenants and received the power of those covenants in what they were doing in winter quarters to bless the lives of other people.
You mentioned that where we had the saints, because they're not all in winter quarters, they're spread out in other settlements and things on both sides of the river. Is there interaction between them much? How is Brigham administering? You mentioned the bishops, but how is there a general administration of the church when they're spread out so much?
Well, they had their own cell phones back then, as you probably know.
The red flags and the green and blue flags.
You begin to see another organization, and that is the High Councils, members of the High Council going two by two every Sunday, if not more often, to visit all these different little hamlets and little groups scattered as they were, branches of the saints, if you will. The organization of the High Council becomes very critical to the cohesion of the saints and the getting the message across. This is what we're going to be doing. We need to get this group ready to leave in the spring of 47. What we were going to do a year ago, we're not really going to do this time. So you're seeing the great communication line is going to be those high counselors, which we pick up on later, as you'll see in the history of the church. And so you're seeing bishops, you're seeing high councils, you're seeing the 70 missionaries functioning amongst themselves, different groups, to strengthen the church. Mm-hmm. Some were struggling with their faith. We must admit to that, yeah. that some were turning back. But very, very small numbers, what we would call staybacks. Their needs, both spiritually and physically, were being met as much as possible under the circumstances.
Yeah.
And yet, they're not going to give in to this. An argument can be made, as far as their singing goes, that the seeds of the tabernacle choir will be sown in winter quarters.
Interesting.
They're going to have choirs singing there, some of the best choir leaders in the church at that time. John Kay was under great demand. He had a golden voice. I wish we could have had a recording of his voice. They loved to sing, and they loved to dance, and they loved to have balls and great dinners. And this was not a place to surrender. This was a place to make a statement. We're going to make it.
Now, there's an interesting thing as we've talked about winter quarters, and we've talked about the Brigham's vision to prepare them to leave in that next spring of 1847. I think as we come to the end of this episode of talking about winter quarters is winter quarters was not just an 1846-47 settlement. Why don't you tell us, even though they leave in the spring of 1847, winter quarters that's not the end of the story for winter quarters.
When you say they leave, that's 147 that are going to leave,
mm-hmm.
and you got thousands left behind. You're going to have 1,400 of them coming out of winter quarters in June or late May, the Grand Camp it was called, 1,400 leaving on their wagons for somewhere in the West.
Uh-huh.
And then you still have 2,000 left in winter quarters, and they're going to have to vacate because by this time, the summer and fall of 47, the Bureau of Indian Affairs has caught up to us and said, you can't stay here any longer. Get out of there. And so we're going to move east now over to Canesville, which is renamed Canesville after Thomas L. Kane later. So winter quarters is finally abandoned late 1847. They're going to burn down some of those old early places that they live, and they're going to go east over there. But, I mean, it's going to take at least six more years for all these saints that are coalescing around the Missouri River to come follow west. So it's a process. It's a careful, laborious, inspired, difficult process of emigration. And, by the way, once they find the valley, then the light turns green for the immigrants in England to start sailing over and coming up the Mississippi all the way up, and we have thousands now coming from England to take the place of those who've gone west. And so it's a revolving door.
Well, thank you, Dick, for sharing with us the inspiring story of winter quarters, and we look forward to having you as a guest on our program in future episodes. We invite all of you as listeners to join us again as we listen to the great stories of the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as we discuss important issues and also hear the inspiring stories and examples of faith of pioneer women and men of the past. And so we invite you again to listen in the future to Past Impressions. I'm Brent Topp, your host, saying goodbye.